Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Colorado's state Supreme Court decision to remove Donald Trump from its ballot based on the 14th Amendment's prohibition on insurrectionists holding office. What might this signal about the court and its role in the 2024 election and in electoral politics more generally? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution forbids persons who participated in insurrections to overthrow the government from holding public office. In response to this, Colorado voters filed a lawsuit to remove Donald Trump from the ballot in that state. The U.S. Supreme Court has just ruled that this lawsuit is unconstitutional and that the former president must remain on the Colorado ballot. So in today's show, we will explore the 14th Amendment. We'll explore this specific case, what this decision means for the broad question about ballot eligibility, for the case against Donald Trump based on the January 6th insurrection, and then broadly for the Supreme Court's role in electoral politics and specifically the 2024 election. Our panel today is John Vile. He's Dean and Professor of Political Science at Middle Tennessee State University, and the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, and Reframers, 170 Eccentric, Visionary, and Patriotic Proposals to Rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Andrew Koppelman is John Paul Stevens, Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University. He's the author of The Increasingly Dangerous Variants of the Most Favored Nation Theory of Religious Liberty, and the Supreme Court and the New Religious Aristocracy in the Hill. And Stanford Levinson is W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School. He's the author of Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Government. Thank you all very, very much for joining us. And John Vile, I'll start with you. What was this case about? What are some of the specifics of this case that was before the Supreme Court?
I think you've given a good summary so far. You have Colorado voters, I believe Republicans, who believe that Trump's participation in the January 6th events on the Capitol constituted an insurrection. So they brought suit under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment basically arguing he was disqualified from running. And there have been two courts before this. The lower Colorado court agreed that Trump had engaged in insurrection, but in a technicality which only constitutional law professors probably can appreciate it, but may not agree with, decided that the president was not an officer of the United States under the language of 14th Amendment, Section 3. The case subsequently went to the Colorado Supreme Court. The Supreme Court accepted most of the lower court decision that Trump had indeed engaged in insurrection and was disqualified, but contrary, and in my judgment, correctly, decided that the president was an officer of or under the United States and could be excluded. There was a similar decision by an official in Maine, and subsequent to this case, there was a similar decision by the in Illinois. Many other states had looked at this, and largely, I think, because of lack of precedent, had turned it down. But the U.S. Supreme Court decided that essentially they decided that the ability to take a name off the ballot for federal elections was a function that could only be performed by Congress. Section 5 of the 14th Amendment gives enforcement power to Congress. And essentially, when it came to federal balloting, the court decided that that was an exclusive power by Congress. So the name remained on the ballot, as we know, on Super Tuesday.
Andrew Koppelman, one of the things that's fascinating about this is there's, although it was a 9-0 decision, there was quite a distinction with different concurring opinions. And more dissent with the majority opinion than a 9-0 decision would suggest, correct?
That's right. So they all agreed that it was inappropriate for an individual state official to take a presidential candidate off the ballot. And the reasoning, I think, is really closest to an earlier decision of the court, Term Limits versus Thornton, where the court said that it wasn't permissible for a state to impose term limits on its members of Congress because the member of Congress was a federal officer. So the basic thought was that with respect to federal elections, there really is a federal question here, and individual states can't interfere with federal elections. And that would have been sufficient to dispose of this case. But the court said a lot more than that. And it's surprising, partly because, as the four justices who didn't join the per curiam opinion said, the court is not supposed to reach out to decide issues not before, and the case had already been resolved. And also, I find it surprising that the reasoning was so weak. So two weaknesses I'll call attention to. One is Professor Weil mentioned Section 5. Section 5 of the 14th Amendment says that Congress will enforce this amendment. And they said, you see, the amendment has no effect without congressional legislation. Well, if that's right, then Brown versus Board of Education is wrongly decided, because Congress had not passed any laws about segregated schools. And if the 14th Amendment only means that it's to be enforced by Congress, then Brown should have been disposed of by the fact that Congress hadn't acted. So I find it really weird that the majority relies on that transparently bad argument. A second transparently bad argument that the majority relies on is the idea that this disability then has to be imposed by Congress. It seems hard to reconcile with the very last sentence of Section 3, which says that Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such disability. That makes sense only if there was a disability already in place that it took 2/3 of Congress to remove. But in fact, if in fact there's no disability unless a majority of both houses impose the disability in the first place, then it doesn't take 2/3 to remove the disability. It only takes a majority, or in the case of the Senate, 40 members to remove the disability. So it's just flatly inconsistent with the text, and the majority doesn't really explain that. So the two big peculiarities is, one, why did they reach out to resolve these issues were not before them? But then second, if they were going to do that, why did they use such manifestly terrible arguments? I mean, we can get into technical minutiae if we are talk about whether, as the trial court said, the president is an officer of the United States. That gets you into textual arguments at the capillary level that I will not get into. But you can at least make those arguments with a straight face. And if the audience is not convinced, at least the audience's eyes will glaze over and the audience will stop paying attention. Whereas anybody can see how bad the arguments were that the majority approved of in this case. So it's all very strange.
And Sandy Levinson, at the core, I mean, at one level, this is a federalism case, it seems like. I mean, who makes that decision? And I know some of the motivation had to have been the threats that states could really kind of go off the rails and just make whatever decision about who's on the ballot. Is this really, at its core, the federal government asserting itself against the states, or is there a lot more going on here?
First thing I want to do is agree with every single word that Andy said. I am often tempted to quote or to paraphrase Tina Turner, what does law have to do with it? And it does seem to me, and here I'm, for better or worse, I sound like an academic, that if this had been submitted as a seminar paper, even for an undergraduate class, let alone in a law school class, assuming you're like, an increasing number of modern law schools that have only honors pass and low pass, under no circumstances would you give it an honors. And if you're generous, you'd give it a pass, but you might even be tempted to give it a low pass, because the arguments really are as bad as Andy is suggesting they are if one is a lawyer of a certain kind, that is, one who listens to the Supreme Court and says, oh, I take text really seriously. So Elena Kagan famously said, we're all textualists now, except for this particular opinion. Or the majority of the Supreme Court says we're all originalists, but to put it mildly, they pay no attention whatsoever to what was going on in the drafting of the 14th Amendment. And this is especially ironic because a very good friend of both Andy's and mine just wrote an absolutely superb book on the history of the 14th Amendment that emphasizes, I think altogether correctly, that what the Republican proponents of the amendment were focusing on was sections 2, 3, and 4, whereas legal academics focus on sections 1 and 5. So then, you know, one has to ask what else is going on. And it's a little bit like Bush versus Gore. The best defense of Bush versus Gore is Richard Posner's, where he said the country was facing a crisis and the Supreme Court saved us from what could have been a really nasty situation with rioting in the streets. Now, you know, as a political scientist, I think we could have an interesting debate on whether Posner is correct empirically. But if you do believe he was correct empirically, or even that the Supreme Court could reasonably have believed we were on the brink of a genuine crisis, then maybe it was kind of both understandable and even defensible that the Supreme Court pulled the rabbit out of the hat, declared George Bush the president, and lo and behold, Al Gore was the world's best sport on December 12th, 2000, and George W. Bush was inaugurated really quite peacefully on January 20th. Yeah. So the court right now could say, you know, we're really on the brink of civil war, which I think is actually not so hyperbolic as one would hope. And stripping Donald Trump of a space in the ballot would not help. So we know that shouldn't happen on reasonable political grounds. And so they make up some reasons that will keep them on the ballot. And I have no doubt that most of the country thinks that's probably the right decision, that only a relatively few legal academics believe that the opinion was both shoddy and wrong.
Sandy, real quick, you mentioned a colleague has written this book on the 14th Amendment. You didn't give us the name.
Mark Graber.
Okay.
Kansas University Press. Great, great book. And it is entirely relevant to the discussion we're having.
It's entitled Punish Treason, Reward Loyalty.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah, I want to make sure to get that out there. And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the 14th Amendment, the recent Supreme Court case reinstating Donald Trump's name on the Colorado ballot, and the role the court is playing in the 2024 election with John Vile of Middle Tennessee State University, Andrew Koppelman of Northwestern University, and Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas Law School. John, one of the issues that certainly came up, whether the reasoning in this case makes as much sense, and I would like your thoughts on that, but also broadly, one of the concerns the court had was, can one state make a decision, you know, that had this profound effect, possibly even for the entire country? So, I mean, I guess at one level, they could have decided simply the whole reason why this needs to be a federal decision is it has a federal impact, but one state makes that decision. Is that at the core of this? Yeah.
You know, the 14th Amendment is primarily directed at limiting state action. So I think there's a little justification for that argument. Well, I'm a little like Sandy on this. In terms of consequences, we live in such a divisive time, if I can throw out a hypothetical, what would have happened if a state had said, we don't believe Barack Obama was born in the United States and we're going to exclude him from our ballot? You know, is there a chance that this would have just sort of resulted in each side trying to gain its own advantage? Now, that having been said, states, you know, we don't have a completely nationalized election. We're going to have probably Robert Kennedy Jr. on the ballots in some states and not in others. And the same for Cornel West. So in that respect, they went a little bit farther beyond what, you know, basically they're saying there's no practice for states doing this. But in fact, when it comes to third party candidates, there is such a precedent.
And I guess to follow up then, is part of the lesson here that we actually should have a much more federal approach to federal elections? That's always been one of the huge challenges, isn't it? That we have, we don't hold one national election, we hold 50 state elections. That's always been kind of an odd characteristic of the American democracy, hasn't it?
I think what's even odder, and I'm pretty sure Sandy will agree with me, probably Andrew as well, Supreme Court has declared that voting is a fundamental right, but there is not an explicit right to vote in the U.S. Constitution. There are prohibitions. You can't prohibit legally someone from voting because of their race or their gender or age over 17. But there's not, because there's not an affirmative right, I think a lot of restrictions, you know, gerrymandering might be an example, but, you know, there are other ex-felons. There's a lot of variation in what happens from one state to another.
Yeah, John is absolutely right that we agree on this. Hugo Black was very fond of talking about our federalism, capitalized O, capital F. Now, as a matter of fact, as you know, a modern liberal Democrat, I generally am not a big fan of federalism. I think there's, you know, I could make an argument that the 1787 Constitution was intended to produce a consolidated government, which is exactly what the opponents of the Constitution said was the case. And generally, I support the centralization that we identify with as the New Deal. That being said, it is not only obviously the case that we are a federal system, but even more so that this Supreme Court is the most federalism-oriented Supreme Court in at least the last 100 years. So one of the reasons why I really do define myself in my sunset years with my original discipline of political science, rather than as a lawyer, even though I teach at a law school, and I'm very happy to be doing that, is that it's just hard to take seriously the professed opinion of the Supreme Court when they talk about the potentially disruptive aspects of our federalism. John is self-evidently correct that the election could be decided by a combination of the inanity of the Electoral College, which is a form of federalism run riot, as well as Robert Kennedy's or Cornel West's or a Libertarian candidate yet to be named, or perhaps Nikki Haley deciding to accept, I'm sure, the telephone calls she's getting right now from the No Labels people to run as a third party candidate. And she would be on the ballot in some states and not in others. So, I mean, the question you asked, there are very good reasons of a policy sort to say that it is ill-advised to have elections run on a decentralized basis of the kind we have in the United States, and that it would be a wonderful thing if Congress exercised its power under the Elections Clause to nationalize the election process, to take away the power that states now have to run elections. That's not our political system today. It's not likely to be our political system in what life I have left in me. And for the court to talk about the disruptive implications of federalism is a very bad joke. I mean, my view is that, well, I mean, there's so many candidates for worst decision of the last 10 or 15 years now, but Shelby County retains a certain pride of place where they, you know, invalidated the most important civil rights act of the 20th century in the name of state sovereignty and the, you know, the duty to protect state sovereignty against an overreaching Congress. And that, and what this allows, as Ruth Ginsburg pointed out in her last great dissent, it wasn't her last dissent, but it was her last great dissent, that it was completely predictable. And if the Supreme Court didn't predict it, then it's they are either knaves or fools. It was completely predictable that Republican states in particular would take advantage of every drop of state authority they have to try to reduce the vote of those they viewed as political antagonists. And surprise, surprise, that is what has happened. So, you know, there's just something repulsive about the claims of disinterested good governmentalism in the majority. Then the question is, and I'd be interested in John's and Andy's speculations on this, why did the three so-called liberals go along? Is it that to be liberal is just to be a centralist and to be viscerally opposed to the messiness of federalism?
Now, Andrew, I want to bring you into this conversation. I mean, Sandy's painted the picture, and we've kind of been painting this picture of a court that has political outcomes that they're seeking, you know, to achieve with possibly, you highlighted this in this case, shaky legal reasoning. How consistent has that been for the court, and what does that mean for court legitimacy? Because, I mean, literally one of the concurring opinions was Justice Barrett pointing out that you shouldn't point out that we have a legitimacy crisis in the courts, which is precisely the poor legal reasoning that you had highlighted is really at the core of a legitimacy crisis. So is that ultimately, I mean, it's one of the real problems that this court faces, isn't it? That it has a political outcome and it doesn't always make a whole lot of sense how they get there.
I will agree with Justice Barrett that it is sometimes impolite to tell the truth. you know, she points that out, and she's correct about that. I do think if you're going to raise the question Sandy raised about why was it a unanimous court, I think that Posner's concern in the 2000 election about the dangers to the country are really stronger here. If the Supreme Court were to say, let's suppose the Supreme Court were to say, you know what, Colorado is right, the guy's an insurrectionist, he is off the ballot. It is quite clear that that decision would have been ignored by the election officials in many red states, and that those red states would have put Trump on the ballot, and he would have carried those states, and then you would have a constitutional crisis when Trump, who could conceivably receive an outright majority of the vote, depending on what happens with Biden's popularity, you get into a situation where you have officials refusing to inaugurate the person who in fact received a majority of the vote. And that's a real danger. So, you know, there really was a danger of disaster here. And so that's the argument for saying that this issue at least has to be federal. But it's also a reason for not reaching any other issue. So, I mean, Barrett worried about the temperature of the separate opinion. But, you know, I think, you know, if I guess my sense about that is if you don't want to be accused of reaching out to distort the law, you might try not reaching out to distort the law, and then people won't accuse you of it.
John Valley, you had some thoughts as well.
One of the things that I would like my colleagues to help me with, I can't tell from this decision if the court were going to have upheld the Colorado Supreme Court decision, the easiest thing that for them to do would simply to have been not to take the case, to leave that precedent in place. That would have kept them, you know, given them a little bit of time to make decisions later. But what I can't tell from the decision, now, my understanding is Jack Smith has not actually accused Trump of insurrection, conspiracy there, racketeering in Georgia. But if he were to be convicted of insurrection, would the Supreme Court accept that as a valid basis for states or for maybe as a requirement for Trump not to be on the ballot? I really don't know the answer.
I don't think that anybody knows the answer. I mean, if I'm always tempted to say, God forbid, Donald Trump becomes president again, there are going to be a lot of people to share the blame. In my present mood, I would put Joe Biden as number one for his insistence on running for re-election, but that's a topic for a different discussion. But I would also include Merrick Garland, that Merrick Garland, I think, would have been a fine, though not particularly outstanding, member of the Supreme Court. That's not his personality to be outstanding. But he would have been a perfectly fine member of the U.S. Supreme Court. I think he was robbed of that seat by Mitch McConnell. And for whatever reason, he appealed to Joe Biden as a nonpartisan attorney general who would restore confidence in a beleaguered Justice Department. And I'm sure that has been Garland's aim. But it is also true that he is so Olympian in his view of his role as attorney general that it appears not to have occurred to him that if you're going to move against Donald Trump after January 6th, then Macbeth or Macbeth's wife got it right. If 'twere to be done, better to be done quickly than waiting until 2024. And so we're in this mess, not only because the Supreme Court, for reasons known only to itself, has decided to wait until the end of April, even to hear argument on the immunity case, but it is the delay in the Justice Department bringing the case. And then, as John points out, they brought it on everything except insurrection. Why? Now, one answer to that is that the Constitution is different today from what it was in 1868. In 1868, nobody took the First Amendment seriously. It was in the Constitution. As somebody who on occasion has taught courses on freedom of speech, I almost, Andy can correct me or John can correct me, I don't recall any pre-1868 cases that are truly relevant on freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is manufactured by the Supreme Court as a subject area in the 20th century. And I'm glad they did it. It's not that I want to go back to the good old days when you could be jailed for blasphemy. But the fact is that modern analysis of insurrection has to deal with American exceptionalism, and that we protect speech that is prohibited in almost all other countries around the world. Hate speech, anti-democratic speech that comes under the notion of militant democracy, particularly in Europe. So, you know, as a blinkered lawyer, let us say, if I were a university president testifying before Congress on what our university would do if somebody advocated genocide, and I had been briefed by lawyers, I would say altogether correctly, merely calling for genocide abstractly is not punishable in the good old United States because of decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1960s. So, you know, none of this existed in 1860. And so cautious lawyers, and nobody is more cautious than Merrick Garland, might have said, well, Donald Trump's speech on January 6th was certainly not admirable. And it certainly might have influenced some people to go march on the Capitol with the guns Trump knew they had. But under Brandenburg, it doesn't quite meet our incitement standards. He didn't use magic words. Now, quite frankly, I'm not sure what the proper response is to that kind of, you know, legal academic analysis of freedom of speech in 2024. That turned out to be a disastrous answer by the presidents of Penn and Harvard, even though they would have gotten an A were they taking a final exam in a First Amendment course.
And then with this, we're talking, I think, broadly about the way in which, whether it's the Department of Justice, but most notably the Supreme Court, and the role that it could potentially play in a number of other areas. Andrew Koppelman's highlighted the fact this could have been a very narrow decision, but it was a much broader one, which might be suggesting that the court is intending on taking a broader role in the 2024 election.
When we come back, the U.S. Supreme Court is signaling that it will play a substantial role in the 2024 election. What might this mean for the future of the U.S., for democracy, and for its Constitution? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Polls suggest that voters want to know if Donald Trump is a criminal before voting in November. But the Supreme Court's decisions make it far less likely that this will occur before the election. What does it mean for the nation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker, and our panel today is John Weil. He is Dean and Professor of Political Science at Middle Tennessee State University. Andrew Koppelman, the John Paul Stevens Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University. And Sanford Levinson, the W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School. Andy Koppelman, you raised this issue that the court could have decided this 14th Amendment case narrowly, but actually decided it much more broadly, which to me signals they intend to take a broader role in electoral politics. Is that a fair assertion? And if so, where do you expect the court is going to delve into?
Well, it's hard to tell because the opinion is so opaquely reasoned. Dissenters say, you know, it's enough to say that this is a federalism case. And then they say, the majority responds by saying, no, federalism is one consideration, but there are these other considerations which altogether, in some unspecified way, add up to our conclusion, thereby implying that the arguments of the concurring opinion are not enough. But they don't explain why it isn't enough. And so, ordinarily, arguments have a structure. one thing leads to another. And the majority presents their arguments. It's not so much a structure as a heap. It is a pile of arguments in no particular order and with no particular arrangement. And so it's hard to tell what the significance of them is. Now, I suppose the one practical effect of the majority's opinion, if it says that nobody is disqualified for the presidency absent a federal statute and there is no federal statute, that could at least be invoked by the Congress when it counts the votes. And if somebody raises an objection that, no, we cannot give the electoral votes to Trump because he's disqualified, someone can say, well, but the Supreme Court has said. That supposes that there will be somebody who will be moved by what the Supreme Court has said, even though the Supreme Court doesn't have any role specified by the Constitution in selecting the president. I suppose that ship sailed with Bush versus Gore, where the court also might have been moved by the fact that the Supreme Court is not supposed to pick the president, and the Supreme Court did. But, what more they intend to do, it's very hard to figure out what somebody's intentions are. I am troubled by the fact that they decided to delay Trump's trial further because they need to seriously consider this manifestly frivolous claim that Trump is making. So far as I can tell, this means that, if you are president of the United States and you shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, the fact that you were president at the time you did it means that you are immune from prosecution. Trump can walk into, when he's president, he can walk into a store on Fifth Avenue and shoplift, and the law can't do anything about it even afterward. It's just a crazy claim. Ordinarily, the Supreme Court agrees to hear questions if they are somehow left inadequately resolved by the lower federal courts. The lower federal courts normally dispose of most federal questions. And the Supreme Court ordinarily does not review the decisions of lower federal courts. And the reason is because most of the time, the lower federal courts are doing just fine. Even if there is a conflict among the lower federal courts, it has to be an important conflict in order to get the Supreme Court's opinion, to get the Supreme Court to hear the case. So why they've decided to hear this case with respect to which there is no conflict among the lower federal courts, and there is not even a colorable claim on behalf of Trump. And so it's just absolutely unimaginable that they will rule in Trump's favor on his claim that he is absolutely immune from prosecution for crimes he commits when he's president. It's hard to look at this as anything other than a gift to Trump. And if we're going to talk about restraint on the part of the liberals, the restraint that seems to me to be particularly impressive is the fact that they did not publicly dissent from the court's decision to hear this case, which certainly looks like election interference, because one thing that we do know from the polls is that there is at least a significant chunk of the electorate who would like to know very much whether Donald Trump is in fact a criminal. That if in fact he is convicted of a crime, we know that an awful lot of the electorate think that their vote would be affected by this information. And the practical effect of the Supreme Court's decision to hear this frivolous claim is the Supreme Court is saying, well, it is none of the voters' business what the truth is about the person they are proposing to vote for president.
John Vile, first of all, definitely seems to indicate that a court that advocates for restraint is actually positioning itself to play an incredibly important political role here. And notably, not only this question, but the one question that the courts haven't taken up and seemingly are trying to ensure that it doesn't take up, is Donald Trump guilty of insurrection or of conspiracy for insurrection? Because one thing we do know is there's lots of people serving jail time right now as a result of insurrection. So the fact that January 6th was an insurrection has been determined by courts, but what exactly was the role that the President Trump played? So a big broad question is, this is a court that's playing a political role. That's not been the history of the court, right?
First, I have to follow up on Andy. If if Trump didn't have to come up with his $100 billion immediately, or no, what is it? However many million, 450 is it that he owns. If he could just make it to the presidency, he might be able to do enough shoplifting to help pay that off. But, you know, you mentioned his example of shooting somebody in Fifth Avenue. The lower court, there was actually a question raised, you know, what if he commanded the SEAL team to assassinate a political opponent? And that does, you know, sort of press the absurdity. And I want to follow up on what Sandy said. I may have a case for it. United States versus Hudson and Goodwin, but I got to look it up to see if they actually mentioned the First Amendment. But it was a Marshall decision dealing with a seditious libel. And I would never have thought about it were I not now reading Wendell Byrd's Press and Speech Under Assault, which deals with the seditious libel laws in England and then how we interpreted them in the United States.
Yeah, I think that dealt, and it even has a strange relevance to our discussion of whether there are common law crimes.
It did.
So, I mean, we know that Congress passed the Sedition Act, and although Thomas Jefferson ended up pardoning people, the Federalists seem to believe the Sedition Act is perfectly constitutional. But in that case, there was no congressional act they could point to. But I think it's only fair to point out that the modern law of the First Amendment is the creation of political liberals and was applauded by political liberals. So that, you know, along the way we applauded defending members of the Ku Klux Klan, like Paul Brandenburg. And I mentioned in my class just yesterday that in my very brief career as a practicing lawyer, one of my clients for the ACLU was the Ku Klux Klan that wanted to march down the streets of Austin, Texas. And it was an easy case to win. And it should have been an easy case to win. So the reason, unfortunately, it's not altogether relevant that I think literally hundreds of people are in jail now for participating in the insurrection on the 6th, is that they attacked the United States Capitol. They, you know, injured police officers. They were looking for Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence. Whereas Donald Trump might be evil, but he's not terminally stupid. And so what he did on the 6th was to give a speech on, you know, a Churchillian speech. We have to fight to maintain our democracy, and I'll be with you all the way. But of course, he wasn't. He went back to the White House. There's some debate about whether he wanted to go to the Capitol, but we all know that he didn't go to the Capitol. And we all know that he didn't use any magic words like, I want you to march in the Capitol and attack it and go find that traitor Mike Pence and string him up. And so, you know, as somebody who has in fact been an ACLU volunteer attorney on First Amendment cases, it is a perhaps unfortunate truth that the Trump arguments aren't simply made up as to why he wasn't guilty of insurrection. Also, I agree with Andy about the frivolity of the absolute immunity claim, but we also ought to recognize that most people seem to agree, rightly or wrongly, that the president does enjoy absolute immunity from criminal liability while in office. So, you know, Donald Trump made his notorious comment when he was a candidate in 2016, and he was talking about his followers. They would have tolerated his shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue. But the awful truth is that thanks to Justice Department lawyers in the Office of Legal Counsel, And we could, again, have an independent discussion on another occasion of the Office of Legal Counsel and what function it serves. But one function is to enhance executive power. And it is because of the OLC that it seems to be accepted across the board that if Donald Trump, while president, shot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, or while president ordered the SEALs to take out a political opponent, we would have to wait until he's out of office in order to prosecute him. Now, some people say, well, that's a high crime misdemeanor, you can impeach him, but the impeachment clause is useless because of political party polarization.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the Supreme Court, electoral politics, the 14th Amendment, and the 2024 election with John Vile of Middle Tennessee State University, Andrew Koppelman of Northwestern University, and Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas. And John, you wanted to respond to some of Sandy's comments?
Sandy beat me to it. I was going to say there is high crimes and misdemeanors. I think that is a case where you could get an impeachment and a conviction. I think I may disagree with him on that, but...
Yeah, no, we can understand.
Pretty extreme.
But Andrew, you actually highlighted the challenge here then, because as Sandy points out, you know, if a president, you know, commits an act as president, the Department of Justice has decided that they can't prosecute while he's president. I think the electorate understands that, which is why they want to know, is Donald Trump a criminal? Because the assumption is if he is a criminal and he's reelected or, you know, elected in 2024, he'll remain a criminal or commit criminal acts as president. But the Supreme Court and other courts, I mean, the entire legal strategy of the Trump team is to make sure that none of these issues are decided by the 2024 election. So we're in this huge legal quandary, and the Supreme Court seems to be contributing to that. So what do we do?
All that we can do is tell the truth about what's going on. I mean, ultimately, this issue is going to be decided by the voters. I mean, the most dysfunctional aspect of the political system is the Electoral College. In the last election, Biden won the popular vote by 7 million votes, but if 40,000 of those votes in particular states had been switched, then under the Electoral College, Trump would have been president. So we really are in a situation very much like England under the old House of Lords, or England when there were what were referred to as rotten boroughs, uninhabited areas that were controlled by a few people who, because they were in those areas, got to outvote everyone else. And, this is a manifestly undemocratic aspect, utterly unrelated to the purposes of the Electoral College originally, which were primarily to preserve the interests of the slave states. There's just no good reason to have the Electoral College today. Its effect is largely random with respect to the original purposes. And there are various measures that could be taken about that. They're not going to happen in time for this election. But the most immediate thing that we can do is try to educate the public about just what the decision is that they're going to be making, which includes information that they may not get in time from a criminal conviction, which has to do with the manifest criminality of Trump. And Sandy has been focusing on his speech before the riot on January 6th. The worst thing I can point to about Trump's behavior on January 6th is actually his inaction and refusal to intervene when people were begging him. You know, there was this mob. They were going to kill somebody. If they had found Mike Pence, they would have killed him. If they had found Nancy Pelosi, they would have killed her. Trump was aware that these were going on, and he refused, despite, you know, enthusiastic fans and even family members begging him to intervene. He refused to intervene because he thought that bringing it about that your opponents get killed is an acceptable way to do politics. This has not been the way that Americans have done politics in the past. It is the way in which politics have been done in many parts of the world, and you don't want to live there. The question in this election is whether we are going to live there.
But Andy, again, you know, I agree with everything you said. When the history of this period is written, assuming we will be enabled to write the history of the period, won't one have to ask why the Justice Department simply sat and did nothing?
Oh, sure. Everything that happens in history has multiple causes, and I'm happy to point to the misbehavior of the Justice Department. Here, as with many aspects of history, I wish I had a time machine and could go back in time. But I think that the most urgent thing for us to do right now is to educate the public about the stakes of what they are going to be deciding now. We cannot change history, but people are still deciding how they are going to vote. The polls indicate that it is a dead heat right now overall. And so the most urgent thing for us to do now is not to rehash mistakes made in the past. I'm not a huge fan of Merrick Garland either, but to make sure that the public understands the decision that they are going to make now. And the past behavior that matters is the behavior that reveals the character of Donald Trump. The fundamental question is Donald Trump going to be permitted to be president again? And the character of Merrick Garland is orthogonal to that.
I agree.
Sandy, go ahead.
You know, again, trying to scope out the Supreme Court, I assume that the decision of the three liberals, although I disagree with it, was an entirely good faith. Because, you know, I have good friends whom I respect who accept the argument that it would just be too disruptive to have state-by-state decisions. And you know, I can understand that argument. I disagree with it as a dispositive argument, but I can thoroughly believe that the three of them were in good faith in agreeing that Colorado couldn't do it. What I find inexplicable, and I really would love to have had, you know, a wiretap on the conversations, why did they consent to the delay until the end of April to hear the immunity case? Because it seems to me that even if they come up with the completely predictable decision that Trump loses because his argument is insane, that if it's a typical Supreme Court opinion, it's not going to come down until the end of June.
Yes.
Because there'll be some dissents or concurring opinions. And then it's going to be just too late to hold a trial before November. And everybody has to know this. And so why did the three liberals go along with this rather than say, okay, there's no need to grant cert at all. The D.C. Circuit opinion really said all that needs to be said. But we'll agree to grant cert on an expedited basis, and waiting till the end of April is an in-kind campaign donation to Donald J. Trump.
And John Val, we've got about a minute left. I'm going to give you the last thought.
Well, if I can add one thing, it is possible that the court, if they vote as most people think they will, that the president does not have absolute immunity. Perhaps they bought a little bit of credibility with this decision. Trump has praised this decision. It's going to be a little hard, although it wouldn't stop him from coming back and saying the Supreme Court is always against me after this case.
Absolutely. And what seems to me where we are is voters want to know, is Donald Trump a criminal? The legal strategy of the Trump legal team is to make sure that that question is not answered before the election. And the Supreme Court seems to be contributing as much as they possibly can. First of all, saying this is a voter decision, not a legal decision. The voters need to make the decision about Donald Trump. But the one piece of information voters most want to know about Donald Trump, the court is doing everything they can to make sure that that's not going to be answered. That seems to me like a political train coming right at us as a country. And although perhaps it's the only option that we have, I agree with Andrew Koppelman, that it's our job to educate as many people as possible about what's happening. Though I admit I'm frustrated that what I'm basically saying is there's a train coming at us and maybe perhaps we should do something about it. And thinking that the best thing I can do is to be that person to say, look at that train. I wish there was more we could do. And with that, I want to thank our guests for discussing the Supreme Court decision about the 14th Amendment, about placing Donald Trump back on the ballot in Colorado, overturning the decision of the Colorado Supreme Court and ensuring that Donald Trump is on that ballot, and then generally about the role the Supreme Court is playing in electoral politics, and in particular, the 2024 election. Our panel today has been John Weil. He's Dean and Professor of Political Science at Middle Tennessee State University and is the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, and Reframers, 170 Eccentric, Visionary, and Patriotic Proposals to Rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Andrew Koppelman, John Paul Stevens Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University. He's the author of The Increasingly Dangerous Variants of Most Favored Nation Theory of Religious Liberty and the Supreme Court and the New Religious Aristocracy in the Hill. And Sanford Levinson, W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School, the author of Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Government. Thank you all very much for sharing your thoughts, your expertise. Very much appreciate it.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.